In some ways, the sermon is a response to when you first brought this up, Jim. That's why I wanted our dialogue to begin at this end of it, because when we look back a number of years ago with the astigmatism of nostalgia, so much looks better in our world. So much looks simpler. We look at medicine, for example, and remember when you could walk into a doctor's office, hand over a $5 bill, and not be buried in paperwork. We remember when doctors made house calls, when you only went to one doctor and didn't have to go through a series of gatekeepers, when we used to complain about doctors playing God instead of what we have now, which is actuaries and accountants playing God. And there's a lot of nostalgia for that. What we forget is that we weren't buried in paperwork, but we were sometimes buried in cemeteries because we didn't have MRIs. We didn't have CAT scans. We didn't have focused cancer therapy that keeps people alive with a quality of life. We also didn't always have the choices that we have now about life, about death, and about dying. And we have a long, as in all civil rights, we have a long way to go and a long conversation to have about end-of-life choices for ourselves, for our families, for the young as well as for the old, because catastrophic injury and disease can strike at any age. But one of the very few things that seems clear to me to have improved during my professional lifetime is in terms of end-of-life choices. When I was younger, there was no hospice program. Doctors who were trained and charged with fighting disease and fighting death too often saw death as the mortal, literally, foe against which they had to struggle and fight even if it killed the patient. They needed to fight that disease, and the battleground was frequently the body of the patient. They did not necessarily have to give the patient good information. Patients were often given bad information because doctors did not want, in principle, to take away hope from patients or from families. And so there was always hope. There was always a reason to go on. And we didn't know always, we still don't know always, but we couldn't even talk about the distinction between prolonging life and prolonging death. And it was very difficult to have quality of life, quality of death conversations with doctors. Many doctors just felt it was a personal failure if a patient died. And we have taken in the 20th century and are beginning to take back the concept of death being a part of nature. That it is not a question of failure all of the time, and it is not all of the time the terrible adversary, the opposite of life, that suffering, physical, mental suffering, diminishment, also need to be factored in by human beings and trying to make humane choices for ourselves and for our families. Right and left across the political spectrum agree that medicine in many ways is broken in this country. An article just this week was released showing that one-third of the bankruptcies filed were due to medical costs. That's stunning. Over 50% of those bankruptcies over medical costs were filed by people who were working and had health insurance, and they were bankrupted anyway, because their coverage ran out, they were moved from one plan to another, an entire group was canceled for whatever reason. that's not reasonable or humane. Why is this happening? Right and left agree that it's happening, don't agree on why it's happening. Is it the trial lawyers or is it the insurance companies? You know something? It's happening. And it's happening, well, there's another reason. Because we have a technology that is extraordinarily expensive and we don't have uncharged by politics and religion moral conversations about whose life it is, whose death it is, and how to deal with the moral calculus without being confused by the monetary calculus. When the doctors told my late stepfather that there was nothing more that medicine could do for his condition, my mother was shocked, appalled, and angry at the doctors. How could they take hope away from this poor man? I asked her, how can you or my stepfather make good medical choices about your own lives, your own body, your own health, without having good information? Patients and their families have a right to good information. Good information is not perfect information. Actuarial tables deal with large masses of people, and it's not a science what's going to happen to any individual. There are miracles, by which I mean, needing to explain this, by which I mean there are changes that are unanticipated and we don't know why. People who are given 6 months sometimes get 6 years. People who are given 6 years sometimes don't make it out of the doctor's office. It's not a science. I'm not even sure it's an art. But we pay attention and we make as good a decision as we can based on as good information as we can get. And it's not perfect. My mother kind of understood that intellectually. But she really didn't understand it viscerally till she went through a health crisis 2 years before she died. And she was knocking at death's door, and I had a very straight conversation with her. I asked her, Mom, if your heart stops, do you want it restarted? And she said, no, I'm tired. I can go. She no longer saw death as the ultimate enemy, but understood that there were things for her, might not be the same for everybody, but for her, that were more troubling than death. Last presidential election being one of them. And she was the first one to say that. I'm quoting now. This is not editorial. But that was Mom, a Democratic National Committee woman, yelling at the television till the day she died. But she came to a different understanding through her own experience and understood that she needed to have good information. But what is good information? What is it that we know and we understand about end-of-life decisions? Who makes the choice about whose life is worth prolonging and when you are prolonging life and when you are prolonging death? When my mother had her final hemorrhagic stroke, and I got to the hospital and I saw her MRI and her higher function was gone, the woman who was my mother was gone, my brother and I were on the same page and communicated straight to the doctors that there was no need to prolong her death. And so hearing the chained Stokes breathing, the labored shallow breaths, they increased her morphine gradually over a period of 24 hours, which eases the symptom, but also depresses the respiration and really is the proximate cause of death. Is that mercy killing? Is that ending life? Is that ending death? It was an intellectually easy call, but not of course, an emotional one because it was Mom. But it was the call that we made together. Had my brother and I been on different sides, they would not have done it. Had she even left an advance directive and I had a power, I did have a power of attorney for health care, and my brother had opposed it, it wouldn't have happened. She no longer had control at that point. But this is a much better situation than it was 40 years ago or 20 years ago. The law of unintended consequences. People died 20 and 40 years ago because they knew that if they allowed a feeding tube in or a ventilator in, it would be impossible to remove those. And so people who might have survived a crisis couldn't take a chance on losing control of their life and of their death. Today, those tubes can be taken out more easily, the respirators and the feeding tubes. Today, kind of counterintuitively, some people can choose to live because they can accept a treatment that they would have been afraid of accepting 20 or 40 years ago, because one of the great fears that most of us have is the loss of control over our own destiny. How do we deal with who's worth saving? We deal with this passively, not actively and honestly, but passively all of the time. Who gets a heart transplant? It's like looking for a used car. If you have a 60-year-old person, are you going to give them the heart of an 18-year-old, virtually unused, low-mileage heart to a 60-year-old? Well, what if the 60-year-old's in great condition and an athlete, and you kind of run the actuarial tables? What if the 60-year-old's a smoking, overweight couch potato? Do you give them a 19-year-old's heart? These decisions are being made informally without a good process all around the world, and society isn't talking about what it is that we want and value, except to the extent that some stand on opposite corners yelling, all life is sacred, do nothing to shorten a life, because it's a slippery slope, and soon you'll be killing people left and right. And others say, I have absolute ownership of my life, and if I'm having a bad hair day and I want to die, take me out. Well, that would have been possible for my mother on some days, too. Her hair was very important. When the doctor told her to swim, she said, not if I'm getting my hair wet. What do we do with the choices that people make and with the positions that people take and with what is worth living? The people who oppose all forms of shortening life medically are not crazy in their concern. We don't have a great history as human beings in dealing fairly and dispassionately with people whom we see as non-productive. We, even in this country, did medical experiments with the treatment of syphilis on black people. We sterilized people with low IQs. Do we, in fact, want to trust our society to say, well, your IQ has fallen under 65.3, and bye-bye, you go. Do we want to consign the old to the ice floes? Do we want to continue spending 80% of the healthcare dollars that will be spent in a lifetime during the last 6 months of a person's life? These are not easy questions. They're not even easy to ask. And they are very difficult to answer. At the extremes, we can say this person is living and it's a living process. At the extremes, we can say this person is dying. There really is no realistic hope of recovery. The higher function is gone, and the pain, whether physical or psychological, is a gonal, and we can't really relieve it, or our crazy society, we won't relieve it because we're afraid they'll become addicted. But the middle areas are the tough areas. And it, in some ways, it's silly not to admit that there's a broad area where this conversation is very, very blurry. And I don't think that we can come up with easy answers based on price and IQ and emotional transference and all the factors that we want to take into it. We can't come up with a system that just uses computers and takes personal responsibility and personal agony out of making these decisions. When you try to hand it over to the computers, you end up with Cal Berkeley not going to the Rose Bowl. The computers are just a way to try to take human beings and human responsibility out of the equation. But it is ultimately our responsibility. What do we do with a demented Alzheimer's patient? Are we prolonging life? Are we prolonging death? How do we deal with people who are profoundly retarded? Without being overly sentimental, I have had some extraordinarily close and fruitful relationships with profoundly retarded people who had wonderful and happy lives. These choices are agony themselves. All I can suggest is a process, and it's not a perfect process. The process starts with not that it's mom or dad or sis or child on that table in that hospital room, but what do I think I would want if I were there? But I've got to even take that position with considerable humility because it's not me there. And I'm only telling you what I think I would want if it were, but it's not. So there needs to be humility in there because I've seen people change their minds when it is when they become the star of the tragedy. So you begin a conversation, and as a society, we need to begin this conversation about the quality of our own lives, the quality of our care, and the judgment about how do we prolong life as opposed to prolong pain and death, and whose life it is and whose death it is. And we have to be very careful that the economic tail does not wag the moral dog. We have to be very careful because there are people on the conservative side who are rightly concerned that an aggressive movement towards a right to die will become a duty to die and a duty, societal duty, not to spend all of that money on all of that life care. That's an intelligent, given history, historic part of the conversation that belongs on the table. And each side needs to respect each other both at the extremes, but most importantly, as we try to find a common ground. Because this is an issue that will profoundly touch each of us eventually in our lives, in our hearts, as those bankruptcy statistics indicate, in our pocketbooks and in our homes. Over the course of my career, I cannot tell you the number of people who had to get divorces in order not to lose their homes to medical expenses. That's a crazy and irrational system. We need to be able to fix this system in the places where we can first find common ground and then try to slowly work our way into broader consensus about ownership of life, ownership and understanding of death and dying. It is the great taboo subject. It is the greatest of our taboos to talk straight about death and dying, because it involves religion, it involves faith, it involves money, and it involves fear, and it must involve love. So we begin this with pain, with hope, but most importantly, I think, with humility in terms of our own judgments.